Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott.
Welcome to the future.
It can feel like the future is a force that we're being swept toward, a different era powered by cutting-edge innovations and technologies. We think of life on distant planets.
Oh my God, I'm on Mars.
Super smart machines.
Robots can free humans from the most repetitive and dangerous tasks.
New methods of transportation. Devon Powers likes to ask her students to imagine what kinds of cars they'll be driving one day.
Tell me what the future of cars is, and they'll all say, oh, it's driverless cars, like it's going to be flying cars.
Devon teaches advertising at Temple University in Philadelphia, and she cautions her students. The future tends to happen in small increments. Go see for yourselves.
Go outside, and I want you to walk around for 15 minutes and tell me what cars you saw. And then they'll come back and they'll be like, yeah, I saw a 1987 Chevy. I saw like a pickup truck that was dinged. And I was like, okay, well, that tells you that like whatever's happened, like those cars are not going away. They're going to be here in 5 years. So even if there's a driverless car, there's also going to be a beat up 1987 Chevy driving next to it. Right. So it's like the future does not change wholesale.
It's also not that far away. In some ways, we always have one foot in the future.
You know, if you say, hey, let's have lunch tomorrow, you've technically thought about the future of your life. If you save for retirement, you've technically thought about the future of your life. Or if you've ever made a plan for a vacation or a plan to marry your partner or anything like that, you've made a plan for the future.
But even though we're technically thinking about our future, the future, you know, in the travel to Mars and hand all control to the robots kind of way, it seems a bit scary.
Most people feel like a lot of things about the future are completely out of their hands. They can't control the economy, they can't control the climate, they can't control if their job is going to exist in a year.
And of course, this past year has been a stark reminder of this lack of control and shown us that our lives can shift quickly. But it has also opened our eyes to new possibilities, that we can do things differently. Today's episode is about the future, our worries and anxieties about it, our relationship with our future selves, and our ability to shape the future we want. Let's start with what we can predict about the more distant future and what it will bring. There are people whose job it is to forecast big changes and new trends. How do they do that? Reporter Alan Yu picks it up from here.
Devon Powers just wrote a book about that industry. It's called On Trend, The Business of Forecasting the Future.
The idea to me that people would pay for understanding the future, it just blew my mind. I didn't realize that that was a thing that somebody could do.
You can call it futurism or trend forecasting. It can be easy to roll your eyes at this. Like in this scene from the TV show Schitt's Creek, when a rich man, David Rose, loses his money and suddenly has to find a job.
What kind of job are you looking for?
Something in like art curating or trend forecasting.
Okay. Let's see. Not seeing anything in art curating or trend forecasting. That's weird.
Okay.
Do you have any other skills or areas of expertise?
I've been told I have really good taste.
Oh, well, that's good. Let's see. Oh, bag boy at the grocery store.
But trend forecasting is a serious business and more of a science than fortune telling. It involves studying the market to see what people already like, looking at what else is popular, and trying to figure out where the world could be in the future.
A lot of companies have to bet on particular products, correct?
So it's like identifying, wow, which racehorse do you think might be winning the race? And how can we identify that?
Sam Devillard is a futurist at a company called Harmony Labs.
I was asked by a publishing company to understand what are the next topics in the self-help book category, for example.
You might think she'd dig into the existing canon of self-help books, but instead, Sam looked elsewhere.
I would look into music, into dancing styles, into hairstyles, into makeup trends, into architecture trends, etc., etc., etc. And when I see a common denominator, then I feel, okay, this might be the zeitgeist formula.
Zeitgeist is a kind of mosaic. Fashion, movies, music, colors, patterns. Sam tries to think about a lot of pieces. For self-help books, for instance, she says that back in the early 2010s, Obama was president, and there was more of a sense of hope.
To believing in something that you can build. It was also a period of globalization, right? Like where we still believed in globalization, where it means that there are no real boundaries, that there are no real walls.
And in the past few years, the mood changed.
It's all more about a retraction, about not thinking too much about the future, thinking more about the present. We had Trump. It's not about globalization. It's about ethno-nationalism. It's retraction. It's about the roots. It's about identity. It's about DNA.
And she wonders if we might move away from those physical, grounded things like walls towards things that are earthy, airy, like the spiritual practice of shamanism.
Like, are there any bestsellers around shamanism? Not yet. But it's going to come.
When Sam tries to put her finger on the zeitgeist, she always thinks about one surprising factor. What drugs are trending right now?
You think about cocaine, you think, when was it that this drug was really, really, let's say, we spoke a lot about this drug around the 80s, correct? So what does cocaine create? It can create a, let's say, bloated sense of self, confidence. It's extroversion, right? And what did we have in the 80s? It was an extroverted time. You had big hair, big shoulder pads, big bodies, muscles. It's no coincidence that cocaine was trending when the Mac Mansions were trending, when Terminator Rumble were trending.
It may sound like she's naming random 80s stuff, but where we hear nostalgic buzzwords, she hears a pattern. To understand her approach, it helps to know that her background is in art history.
First, I studied art history, comparative religion, and sociology in Germany, and was very enamored with the 16th century Spanish art. You could see correlations, particular periods of time have similar formulas that will translate cross-categorically. So the type of music would correspond, have a similar style to the type of architecture, to the fashion, to the mannerisms, to the food, etc., etc., etc. And then at one point I thought, oh, what am I doing in the 16th century?
Her work is a little like art history, but in reverse. Art history looks at the products of a certain culture and tries to think, what does this say about the culture? Trend forecasting tries to understand the culture and think of the next product that people will need or want.
Also, the way how I started to interpret the world, and it's such fun when you can take any conversation snippet and see if, you know, if it fits into your system or doesn't, or if you could like improve the system of interpretation. And anyway, I thought, where can I do this? I thought, no way, academia is too myopic. No. And then I thought, fashion.
Sam says fashion is an industry where you interpret trends and you can get concrete results relatively quickly.
By the numbers, the sales numbers, that's very reassuring to see, did this hit the nerve or did this not hit the nerve?
For example, back in the 90s, she noticed a trend in clothing and styles that weren't symmetrical. She spotted this trend, reported it to her team and her client, and the result was an asymmetrical bag.
It's tiny, petite. It's of course like more a container for your keys, maybe your credit card, or who knows, a lipstick. It does not offer much space.
The design was not at all practical. It's shaped a little like a kidney, so no matter what you put in it, the weight just goes to one side. But it was a hit. Became a classic for her client, Christian Dior. They called it the saddlebag. It's been on Sex and the City. Beyoncé had one a few years ago. In recent years, Sam has become interested in the methods of trend forecasting. She wants to know, how did the best forecasters get their incredible intuition?
I will not say clairvoyance in that classical sense. It's not looking into the crystal glass, but have a real, very good understanding of where things are moving.
She now teaches trend analysis and future forecasting at the Masters in Branding program at the School of Visual Arts in New York. She adds that not everyone uses her method, and also not everyone does it well.
There's a lot of bullshit as well.
So how can you tell what is that and what is good trend forecasting? Leia Zaidi is a futurist at the Future Today Institute. She says if forecasting is done well, you should come up with concrete advice for what's next.
A good strategy is actionable. It's not something that is meant to be nebulous. It's not, you know, a very fluffy description of like, you should consider this.
In other words, it should not be a horoscope, something that is so intentionally vague it could apply to almost anything. Leia said an example of a good strategy is you should invest in renewable energy because the way the world is going, no matter what happens, that is going to be important. So futurism isn't predicting the future. It's a skill where you look for patterns, currents that drive culture. It's also an ability to see the world and imagine that it could be different. But who gets to shape what our future looks like may depend on how much power they have. When Elon Musk talks about the future of transportation as a network of underground tunnels, it gets attention.
What I think this really amounts to is an actual solution to the soul-crushing burden of traffic. This is something that I think will actually work.
It's Elon scalable. Musk can say like the future of transportation is Hyperloop. But he's just saying that, right? And I could stand up and say, like, the future of transportation is, like, me on my bike. But, like, people aren't listening to me. People aren't throwing millions of dollars at me when I say, ride in my bike.
That's Devon Powers again. She says we could all play a more active role in our own future.
Businesses have figured this out. And they've figured it out in ways that have impacts on all of our lives. And so I think it's only fair to, and it's only sort of just for everyday individuals to also recognize that this is a practice that you can bring into your everyday life and that you can bring into your professional life so that you can kind of balance that control. And it's not just more powerful interests than you that are deciding what future you will live.
Once she realized this, she says she saw the world a little bit differently. For example, she lives in a quickly gentrifying neighborhood in Philadelphia. She was at a community meeting where property developers were telling neighbors about their plans to build more high-rises and parking and businesses.
They say things like, well, you know, this is the future, right? The future of Philadelphia is more, you know, tall buildings and more density on the streets and more people walking around, and you just have to sort of go with it. I started to intervene when I heard language like that. And I was like, the future is not predetermined, right? You don't get to tell me what my future is. And so that's just, you know, a very sort of small example. And it's not as though that way of thinking has stopped all of the development happening in my neighborhood. It for sure has not. But I think it's a very empowering way to think. We have seen across 2020, hundreds of thousands of people in this country saying, I want my life to look different. You know, I demand racial justice. You know, I demand healthcare. I demand a home. I demand a fairer wage. And I think we have seen, despite a lot of setbacks, I think we've also seen some moments of victory and some moments of awareness.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. It's hard to build a different future when the status quo is very much ingrained in our thinking, our behavior, and the infrastructure we've built. When it comes to our cities, cars have long been king of the road. Cities have been designed around cars, with networks of roads and highways to get places fast. But many activists say our future cities have to serve people, not cars. Cars have a serious cost in terms of pollution, noise, traffic, and deaths and injuries. A few years ago, Jad Slaman brought us this report on what a less car-centric future could look like.
Kids skate around, dart back and forth, playing tag and soccer. They scream for no apparent reason. It feels like a playground at recess, but it's a city street, 78th Street to be exact, in Jackson Heights, New York City. Almost a whole block of it has been closed to car traffic since 2011. 8-year-old Alexandria and her friends pass around a volleyball. This is her favorite part of the neighborhood.
Because, like, it's large, and also, like, I get to have space to play soccer and other different sports.
Jackson Heights is a diverse, densely packed part of Queens. It's got far less park space than almost every other city neighborhood. Alexandria's cousin Sarah is old enough to remember playing on this block before the closure.
It wasn't really much, and it was kind of hard because, like, with the cars passing by, I don't know, like, I was kind of scared because, let's say, a ball, like, flew over. No, I didn't want to be in the traffic.
When the city blocked off the street for the first time, Sarah says it was weird.
I think it was a good kind of weird. I don't know. It was because, like, we're not used to it because I was so used to cars passing by.
A group of activists first started working on closing the street more than a decade ago, and there was a lot of pushback.
There was fear that we were going to lose parking places. There was fear that we were going to cause traffic on adjacent streets. There was fear that there was going to be, all of a sudden, even though there's not really problems with gang activity in this park, that all of a sudden there's going to be, like, gang turf battles in this street.
That's Donovan Finn, an urban planning professor who was part of the push and lived in the neighborhood. Gatekeepers, as he calls them, city officials, community board members, thought he was nuts.
There's something about when you tell people you're going to close a piece of street, I think it just creates this, the situation in their mind where they just can't fathom it. It just seems so unlikely that you could just turn a street into a public space that they just can't imagine it.
The thing is, Donovan was waging a kind of insurgency in a war cars had won decades ago. It was a battle over who the streets were for, and about 100 years ago, it was life and death.
The automobiles were killing people at an incredible rate.
That's Peter Norton, a technology historian and author of Fighting Traffic, a book about how cars made their way into our cities in the first place.
And in cities, the people getting killed were overwhelmingly pedestrians. Many of them were children.
But cars were getting more convenient. They were getting cheaper and more people could afford them. So instead of reining in the cars, cities and communities around the country started to plan around the needs of drivers and required everyone else on the road, pedestrians, bicyclists, public transportation, to get out of the way. And Peter says part of the victory of cars was a psychological one. It started with the kids. By the mid-20s, the top funder of public school safety education was the American Automobile Association, AAA.
They took over the safety patrols, guided the children to school, and helped them cross the street safely. And their message to children was, streets are for automobiles.
Check left, right, and left again. When it's safe, you should motion to the students to cross while continuing to check for moving cars.
When these kids grew into adults, that was ingrained in them. They simply knew the streets were for cars. And the rest is history. Peter isn't a big fan of cars. I expected him to bike to the office. He works in this sprawling college town. But no, he backs out of his driveway in a four-wheel internal combustion automobile.
And I think that quite arguably makes me a total hypocrite. But my answer is that, like other people, I have to live in the world we've got.
Cars won. That's the world we live in. Peter says public investment in cars has come at the detriment of other ways to get around. Millions like him have no train they can walk to, no reliable bus. They can't pedal along a freeway from the suburbs. In big cities, public transit is often underfunded and struggling. But have cars won for good?
Somewhere around 2003, 2004, I began to notice that people were driving a little less in New York City. And soon I began to notice they were driving less in cities around the country.
That's Sam Schwartz, aka Gridlock Sam. He's the New York urban planner who coined the term gridlock. He says younger Americans are rethinking their relationship with cars. They're not part of the American dream for them. And cities are thinking about reducing cars too, not just the usual suspects, the New Yorks and Chicagos. Smaller cities are reaching out to Sam.
Fargo, North Dakota, Boise, Idaho, Des Moines, Iowa, Grand Rapids, Michigan.
They want to know how to get by with fewer cars. Sam knows a thing or two about that. In the 70s, he tried and almost succeeded in getting cars out of a huge chunk of Midtown Manhattan, some 60 blocks.
All cars were going to be banned from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m.
He got so far as stamping out the signs, but a new mayor scrapped it last minute. Hotel owners pushed back, and really, it was just too radical. Instead, only Madison Avenue closed, and only temporarily, starting on Earth Day.
And all the mad men and mad women of the early 1970s came out during lunchtime with sandwiches, picnics, bottles of wine, and enjoyed the fresh air on Madison Avenue that probably hadn't been seen in nearly a century.
The picnics came and went, but Sam says his ideas aren't so radical anymore. In 2019, New York officials announced congestion pricing was coming to Manhattan.
New York City is set to become the very first city in the nation to levy a congestion tax on drivers.
You shoved this down my throat just like you shoved the bicycle lanes down my throat, and now you want me to pay for it.
Drivers would be charged roughly 10 bucks for driving into the city, anywhere between 60th Street, where we are now, down to the tip of Manhattan.
The fees go to public transit. The idea is less car traffic in urban centers, and it's worked in Singapore and London.
Do you get up in the morning and you're like, thank God, I get to go sit in my car for an hour in traffic?
That's Lynn Richards, president of the Congress for New Urbanism.
Nobody wants that as an outcome.
They're a collective of engineers, policy wonks, and scientists. They fret over what cars have done to our cities and, by extension, our health and environment. But they're not anti-car exactly. They just oppose prioritizing them over other kinds of transport, putting highways before rail lines, parking over bike lanes.
I'm not asking you to give up your car. I have a car. I like my car. I drive my car. I also love the fact that I can get to work faster on my bike than any other mode of transportation. So we're talking about creating choices on how to get around.
Lynn says if you want to create a different future, you have to make it happen in small steps to make the possibilities visible.
It's called tactical urbanism.
Start with small car-free spaces and make it temporary so no one freaks out.
If you wanted to narrow a street in a downtown area instead of, oh my gosh, what happens to the parking, et cetera, you use hay bales and temporary seating and paint to transform the street.
That's how the future got started at 78th Street in Queens, as a temporary thing. A couple weekends in the summer, then the whole summer, then, hey, why not the whole year?
Very quickly, you know, kids are learning to ride bikes here. People were having birthday parties for their kids.
That's Donovan again, one of the activists behind the 78th Street closure.
Just because of the linear shape of it, people were setting up soccer goals at each end and having soccer games.
The most encouraging thing to him, the kids on 78th Street who have never thought of it as a street.
To them, this is just how it is and how it would always be.
These kids are growing up learning at least one street isn't for cars. It's for them.
That story was reported by Jad Slayman. There has been less traffic during the pandemic, which has maybe given us a bit more of a taste of a future with fewer cars. And a lot of cities have now converted street space into room for outdoor dining igloos. For many people trying to shape the future, the environment is a major issue. Saving the world from climate change and preserving the planet as a livable space for all creatures. And that includes animals that have all but gone extinct.
The northern white rhino is a beautiful creature. They are quite large, one of the largest mammals that you can see roaming on land. My name is Jan Stayskal. And I work as a director of international projects at Vukralova Zoo, which is based in the Czech Republic.
Jan heads international efforts to save the northern white rhino. It's a race against time.
There are only two females left. There is no other known to the world specimen of the northern white rhino, so they are really on the brink of the extinction. You know, from my perspective, to lose them would be kind of tragedy.
Jan says the main threat to these rhinos has been us, humans. There is a long history of poaching these rhinos for their horns. In the early 1900s, their numbers were still in the thousands. But in the second half of the 20th century, the numbers dwindled dramatically.
In the early 80s, we are down to only 15 animals. And at that time, I think everyone understood that this is a really critical situation.
During this time, 6 white rhinos were brought to Jan Zoo from East Central Africa to start a breeding program.
To take them to a zoo meant that you prolonged their existence on the earth.
But the animals living in captivity were not reproducing, and a health check showed that none of them were biologically able to have offspring. That meant it would take reproductive medicine, IVF, to make this happen. In 2015, scientists from all over the world met in Vienna to come up with a plan.
As something like a roadmap how to save the northern white rhino.
Since then, different institutions from Europe, Africa, and Japan have all been working together to figure out how in vitro fertilization could work in rhinos. It was a steep learning curve, but they had frozen sperm that had been collected from the last males before their deaths. They were able to harvest eggs from the females after first trying this process out on their much more abundant relatives, the southern white rhino. And now you have 5 northern white rhino embryos, right?
Yes, now we have 5 pure northern white rhino embryos.
Wow. So what are you going to do next? Because, I mean, if this is anything like human in vitro fertilization, it's not always successful. And now you have this very precious cargo here.
Exactly. So what we need is actually that we need to continue in collection of eggs from the last living donors to try to produce as many embryos as possible. Of course, the reason is that we do not know how many embryos we will need to be successful mm-hmm. with the embryo transfer to a surrogate mother.
Tell me the pro and con on this effort. You know, I'm sure there is an argument to be made. Look, this happened, and we just need to let it be what it is. And then there is the argument to be made to say, no, we have to do something. We have to shape the future we want to see.
I think what is necessary to understand is that the northern white rhino is on the brink of extinction, not because of some, let's say, very natural causes. It's just because human greed, it's just because a false belief in the properties of a rhino horn. So from our perspective, if we have at our fingertips techniques that can help them to survive, it's a moral thing and we are obliged to try to save them. I think we have to admit that we will fail. It's definitely not granted that we will be able to save the northern white rhino. But the knowledge that we gathered during the whole process, that's something, you know, what can be of really huge use, even in other conservation-related issues.
But he also worries about how his success could cause others to take issues around extinction less seriously.
I do not want that our work is perceived like it could be used for any species that will get into trouble. Mm-hmm. I would be, much more happier if there would not be any other species that would get so far as the northern white rhino.
Best case scenario, what is the future you see with the northern white rhino?
I still, again, have to admit that this still seems as a bit of a dream. But on the other hand, you know, if we wouldn't have dreams, you know, our lives would be boring. So the dream is that in, let's say, about 20 or 30 years, we have a so healthy population that we are able to send the northern white rhino back to the original range.
Jan Stejskal is director of international projects at Dvor Králové Zoo in the Czech Republic.
Dvor Králové.
Dvor?
And then Králové.
K Kralove. Okay.
Dvur, Kralove, yeah.
Dvur Kralove. Oh, how do you say the V?
Dvur. Dvur Kralove.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, we take a look at the future in more personal ways. How do we relate to our future selves?
I'm so fearful of the future. Like, totally terrified. I don't want to lose everyone.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable, quality health care for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the future, how we envision it, and how we see our role in shaping it. Earlier on, we heard from futurists. They get paid to predict trends, to figure out what big changes are coming, what consumers will want or need in decades to come. That sounds exciting, right? But when psychologist Hal Hirschfield was first approached to look into the future, it didn't sound very glamorous to him at all.
So actually, when I was in graduate school, I was sitting down to talk to my graduate advisor, and she made the observation that there's a big problem with retirement savings, and more psychologists needed to do something about this, and why is it only economists? And she said, you know, you should do that. We should do that together. And I looked at her and I said, that sounds incredibly boring to me. And she said, but that's the point. She said, that's the point. People who are young, like I was then, think it's boring to talk about the future and to talk about planning and whatnot.
But Hal changed his mind. He's now a professor of marketing and behavioral decision making at UCLA, and he studies our relationship with the future. What part of thinking about the future relates to anxiety? I kind of see a connection there that you think about the future, you try to figure out what's going to happen, you try to be prepared, which is good, but on some level to me it also ties into being anxious.
People don't like uncertainty and they try to avoid uncertainty. Even if a certain outcome in the future is objectively worse than the possibility of a better one, people go for the certain one. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the future is inherently uncertain. We feel anxious when we don't know what's going to happen. And of course, we try to place some control over this, whether it's through planning or sort of simulating the future in our mind's eye, you know, iterate on it over and over to think about how things might happen. But, you know, that only goes so far. But it's one of the ways that we end up dealing with some of that anxiety.
Are people generally good at predicting their own future in terms of what will make for a good life for them and how to get there?
I think there's a lot of work suggesting that we're pretty bad actually at predicting our own futures, especially how we'll feel in the future. We tend to over project our current interests and our current tastes onto our future selves.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that's not super fair. We think we like a basic, you know, a certain band now. We assume we'll continue to like them for 5 or 10 or 15 years, when in fact our preferences and tastes change. And that can be problematic because people make commitments to certain, you know, endeavors when maybe they should recognize that things can change.
And because of that, Hal says it's best to be flexible.
From my perspective, none of these types of decisions about the future, none of these sort of mindsets or ways of approaching the future, you know, can be or should be black and white. there's got to be some balance here. So, you know, if I said, well, just free yourself and let life happen to you, well, I think then you'd really be missing out.
Mm-hmm.
And if I said to you, you know, take control and be an agent and plan everything, well, I also think you'd be missing out. So, you know, I think there clearly has to be some balance there.
Is there a blueprint? Are we learning anything about people who are successful and whether they have anything in common in terms of how they approach their future?
You know, so some of my own research looks at the relationships that people experience or report to experience with their own future selves. And we know that people feel some sort of emotional connection to their future selves, you know, tend to make decisions right now that benefit those selves. That may sound sort of straightforward, but it actually can get pretty complicated because a lot of people don't stop and think deeply about who they'll become in the future. You know, vividly who that person is and what they want that person's life to be like. So I think that's one aspect that we know defines people who, you know, seem to have approached the future in a positive way.
It can be really hard to envision our future, what it will be like, what we will be like. And Hal really illustrated that with something called the vampire problem.
So the vampire problem is a philosophical thought experiment. It's by Lori Paul. She's a philosophy professor at Yale. I first heard her talk about this about 5 years ago. I was at a very small conference and she raised this question and she said, imagine all of your friends are becoming vampires. They tell you, you know, you too should become a vampire. You know, look like you like to wear kind of dark clothes. You look like you might stay up late at night a lot, and you have a preference for novel foods. So you would love being a vampire. Once you become a vampire, you can't unbecome a vampire.
Mm-hmm.
And the act of deciding to take on this role may in fact change who you are, and it may in fact change your preferences in ways that you could never have anticipated. And she's talking about this. It's 5 years ago. I'm listening to her. And 3 days earlier, 3 days I found out earlier, I found out that my wife is pregnant with our first kid. And I'm sitting in the back of the room thinking, oh my gosh, this is about being a parent. And I'm starting to freak out because I realize it's not just that we're going to have a baby, but we're going to have a whole kid and I'm going to be a parent. And who knows what my preferences will be. And as I'm having these anxious thoughts, she says, of course, this is a veiled analogy to becoming a parent. And her point, I think, is a really, really smart one, which is that we can plan for the future and we can think about the future and we can try to simulate the future. But when we turn into our future selves, however we define that, when we become these sort of new versions of ourselves because some life events may have happened, that may alter some of our core ways of seeing the world in ways that we can't sort of predict. And I don't think that's a problem. I don't think that means that we should be paralyzed with fear and anxiety about the future. I think it means that we should have some flexibility and some forgiveness of our future selves and what their preferences may be.
Yeah, I think in becoming a parent, I felt that feeling of sort of walking toward a future that I couldn't envision and I couldn't understand, but I also couldn't walk away from. Like, I felt that, oh my God, the future is happening, and I don't know.
I felt that way and I still feel that way, and it's a hat that you sort of will always wear.
Is there a good relationship advice for our relationship with our future selves? Like, how should we engage with that future version of us?
Yeah, I love that question. You know, in a lot of my work, part of my goal is to try to change the conversations that people have with their future selves. And so, you know, I think, you know, one aspect of this is to, you know, respect the idea that our future self will ultimately benefit from or suffer as a result of the decisions that we make now. And I think people kind of intuitively know that, but when you really think about it, I think it puts a little bit more weight on the decisions we make right now. It's not just that we can decide to do something and hope things work out. There's somebody at the table with us who experiences the outcomes of our decisions right now.
Hal Hirschfield is a psychologist and professor of marketing and behavioral decision making at UCLA. He just said that our future selves are at the table with us. They are impacted by all of our decisions. Don't you wish you could talk to that future self sometimes? Our next story from reporter Liz Tung looks into that possibility.
On the morning of his 30th birthday, Nicholas woke to find an email in his inbox. Here he is reading it.
Hey there. Happy 30th birthday. I know you've been dreading it for a long time, so maybe it isn't so happy. Happiness isn't something that feels very possible right now. It's been a hard couple of years.
The writer should know, because the writer was Nicholas. He'd sent the letter to himself a year and a half earlier, using a website called Future Me. It's a pretty simple concept. You write a letter to yourself and then choose when you want it delivered. A year, 5 years, whatever. Nicholas had written his letter when he was 28, at a moment when it seemed like his whole life was on the brink of falling apart. Here's more from the letter.
Everything feels like it's in jeopardy. The only way I know I can keep the people I love in my life is to keep living a lie, to keep hiding.
The lie Nicholas was writing about was his sexuality. Over the past few years, Nicholas had realized he was gay, which for him was a major problem. That's because a lot of Nicholas's life, his family, his friends, even his job, revolved around a very conservative branch of Christianity.
People who believe we should still stone the gays. I kid you not.
Nicholas had been hearing these opinions from the time he was a teenager, and they made an impact, shaped how he thought about what it meant to be gay. There was never a question of accepting his sexuality. Instead, he thought of it as something he had to overcome.
It was my struggle, it was my cross to bear, or whatever you want to call it, and it was a problem that I either had to live with or get rid of.
The solution, Nicholas figured, was to do what he was supposed to do. Get married, to a woman, of course, and wait for the feelings to go away. So that's what he did. Though Nicholas emphasizes this wasn't some marriage of convenience. They really loved each other. And from the beginning, it felt like fate.
We were best friends when we were young, you know. Honestly, we felt like God told us to get married.
And at first, things were good. They had a child together, a daughter, who became the light of their lives. But as the years went by, that niggling feeling that something wasn't right continued to grow.
And it made our marriage very complicated and ultimately not worth pursuing anymore.
By the time he wrote the letter to himself, Nicholas had already admitted to his wife that he was gay. They didn't split up immediately, but the fallout was painful. Still, he wrote in his letter, he didn't regret getting married.
You got perhaps God's greatest gift because of those decisions. Had you come out as gay right after high school or on the heels of that horrible relationship before your marriage, you wouldn't have your daughter. She's so goddamn amazing. She's kind of the only thing we've got going right now. Hopefully, things are better with the wife, whether you're married or not. Either way, she used to be your best friend. I hope she is again.
But this was just the tip of the iceberg. At the time he wrote his letter, Nicholas had only come out to his wife and a few other people.
I'm so fearful of the future. Like, totally terrified. I don't want to lose everyone. I don't want to lose my family, my friends, my job. Okay, maybe I'd be cool without the job, haha.
Nicholas worked at a nonprofit Christian organization, one that had zero tolerance for being gay.
You actually sign a contract when you get hired saying you won't be gay. I kid you not. And so if this ever got out, I would have been fired. And I worked there with family members. I worked there with two of my best friends. And so I just couldn't let them know or talk to them about it or anything, just on the chance that someone else there find out and I lose my job and now all the money for my family and everything like that.
In his letter, Nicholas wrote that he felt trapped and he yearned for a time when he could be free.
My entire life has been a lie, or at least a lie has been a part of my entire life. Did I keep on hiding? Do I still lie?
The people Nicholas was most concerned about telling was his family. Their relationship was already strained, and the secret of his sexuality was only making it worse.
I hope you fix things with your parents. Probably depends on if they ever find out.
So that's where Nicholas was when he wrote the letter, stuck in a state of flux and fear, but still hopeful that by the time his letter came back, things might have changed.
I hope my future isn't scary. I hope you're happy. I hope you live to read this. I hope you still know that God loves you, even with the gay.
By the time Nicholas received his letter, a year and a half later, a lot had changed. He and his wife had separated. Their divorce actually came through a week or so after his 30th. He quit his job and found another one he liked better. And just a couple weeks after the letter came, he finally jumped one of the biggest hurdles he'd been facing, telling his family.
To be honest, it went exactly like I thought. They all did exactly, you know, what I expected. And I think, while it would have been out of character for anyone in the room to say anything like, hey, you know we still love you, right? I think I was hoping someone would step up, and I feel like I baited it, and I tried to put it out there, just give them the opportunity, but it, you know, it didn't happen. And so it didn't happen. I don't know. Doesn't mean they don't. It doesn't mean, you know, I don't want to tell a whole story around something that isn't necessarily true. And so I just kind of have to take it as it is and move forward.
It's the messy reality of how our lives unfold. We like to think of the future as a fixed destination, where things, including ourselves, become transformed, where we hope at least some of the answers to our life's questions will arrive. Nicholas appealed to that hope at the end of his letter.
Did you ever figure it out? Like, really figure yourself out? Do you have an ounce of peace? It feels so far away right now. They say time heals. I guess you'd know better than me.
Future Nicholas, which is just present Nicholas, says he doesn't have all the answers to those questions, not yet. But getting his own letter back, it actually helped put things in perspective, see how far he'd come on the tail end of a very, very tough transition. It also helped him realize that the transformation he'd been hoping for isn't so much a fixed destination as it is a process, one he's still moving through now.
I don't have it all figured out. I'm not in the best place, but I'm not in the worst place, and I am in a better place, and I have grown since writing the letter, and a lot's changed, and some of it's been hard, and some of it's been good.
That story was reported by Liz Tung. The audio we heard from Nicholas, reading his letter and reflecting on his experience, is from the new podcast, Hope This Finds Me Well. Special thanks to the hosts, Maria Passingham, Steph Colburn, and Sophie Shin. Season 1 is coming soon wherever you get your podcasts. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Sojourner Ahebe is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.